This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that we take one of those issues that you feel you need to know about, bring together some of the top minds on the subject, and take 28 minutes to get briefed up on it. You can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds, and it'd be really helpful if you could tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. Our question today, after the Nissan investment decision, is car making in Britain doomed? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Back in 2016, when Nissan chose Sunderland to build its next generation of SUVs, the city celebrated and the UK government breathed a sigh of relief. Maybe Brexit wasn't going to put off foreign investors after all. But this week, the Japanese carmaker reversed its decision and announced that the X-Trail will be made not in England, but in Japan. And today there was more bad news, with Jaguar Land Rover posting big losses and Honda announcing job cuts in Swindon. So this week we're asking, is car making in Britain doomed? Step inside the briefing room to find out. First, let's discover how a Japanese firm like Nissan became such a big player in the British economy. We asked two of the country's leading experts to give us a potted history of UK car making, and you'll hear first from Dan Coffey from the Leeds University Business School, and then from Professor David Bailey from the Aston Business School.
What makes the British car industry different in Europe is the only country which once had a massive and dominant indigenous industry, and today it doesn't have an indigenous car industry. The first crunch point came with the collapse of British Leyland. British Leyland was formed in 1968 to be a national champion for Britain, and at that point it was Britain's biggest manufacturer and one of the biggest manufacturing organisations in Europe.
Leyland Cars. Austin MG, Triumph, Mini, Jaguar, Daimler, Princess, Morris, Rover. All with Supercover. Great cars and a great deal more.
After Britain entered the European community, the British car industry was flooded with imports. In 1968, only 10% of the British car market was imports. By 1980, it was 60%.
I bought foreign because for pounds, shillings and pence, this offers me the best car I can find.
This is my second Renault. For me, it's perfect.
I used to be intensely loyal to British manufacturers, but it's my money I'm spending after all.
Britain was flooded by car imports, and British Leyland came under enormous pressure. It was defensively nationalised in 1975, and between 1975 and the election of the first Thatcher government, it became a political hot potato. What to do with British Leyland? The election of the first Thatcher government, 1979, changes everything. What the Thatcher governments want are investment, jobs and companies in Britain, but they don't have to be British companies. The nationalism around a British industry dissipates, and it's now about investment from any quarter, and we don't care who owns the companies. You want a car industry, but not necessarily a British car industry.
I wish Nissan Motor Manufacturing United Kingdom a prosperous and profitable and happy future.
The first companies in the 1980s to come to Britain were Nissan, who went to Sunderland in the northeast of England, Honda, which set up a facility in Swindon, and Toyota, which established operations in Derbyshire. From the viewpoint of the Japanese, Britain could get access for Japanese-made cars in the European market. Until this point, Europe had limited Japanese imports through quota systems. Britain was an entry point and a political ally within Europe to open up the European market. The second thing Britain offers is cheap and flexible labour, but skilled labour in an increasingly deregulated labour market. The third thing Britain offers is access to a high science and technology base. On top of this, if you go to France, the French government supports French companies. If you go to Germany, the German government supports German companies. Britain is a level playing field, no matter the point of origin of the company investing in Britain.
The 1980s and 1990s saw British-owned car manufacturing continue to struggle. What was left of British Leyland became the Rover Group. It was privatised by the government. Rover Group was able to make very limited profits on the back of a close relationship with Honda. It largely took Honda-badged cars, rebadged them and re-engineered them slightly as Rovers. And then it was taken over by BMW, the German-owned company. It acquired Rover Group in 1994. Now, BMW then ran Rover Group in the UK until 2000, when it pulled out. BMW kept Mini production and a new Mini design, which it kept at Oxford. What remained of it, the rump of Rover Group, was sold to the so-called Phoenix Four at Longbridge in Birmingham. And they managed to kind of limp on for another 5 years before the company finally collapsed in 2005. Jaguar Land Rover became owned by Ford. That was then later sold off in the mid-2000s to the first big Indian investor in the form of Tata. So by the mid-2000s, the mass UK-owned car industry had disappeared. The industry in the UK peaked at the end of the 1990s with just under 2 million cars made. It then entered a period of decline. And there were two reasons for that. One was exchange rate overvaluation, which made exports more difficult. The other big thing was that Europe was enlarging, and there was a lot of investment by the major multinational car companies in Central and Eastern Europe, where labour costs were lower. So what we saw was a switch in production away from Western Europe to Central and Eastern Europe. A classic example of that was Peugeot, which closed its plant near Coventry in 2007 and shifted production of small cars out to Slovakia, where wages were much lower.
Looking at the map of Britain today, there are a number of obviously strong regions for car manufacture. You've got Toyota in the East Midlands in Derbyshire, and the West Midlands is Jaguar Land Rover, which is active in Solihull, Castle Bromwich and Wolverhampton. You've got BMW making engines, there are taxis made in Coventry, there are trucks made in Warwick. So the Midlands is a hive of activity, east and west, in the car industry.
Then in the northwest, there are Jaguar Land Rover plants at Halewood and also a Vauxhall plant now owned by Peugeot at Elmsmere Port, making the Astra model.
You've got Toyota engines in Dee Side and Wells in Oxfordshire. You've got BMW. You've also got a very strong motorsports cluster.
Honda is based in the southwest at Swindon. And you've also got engine producers. So, for example, Ford, whilst it doesn't make any cars in the UK, it makes engines at both Bridgend and Dagenham.
Moving to the northeast, you have Nissan in Sunderland and also an electric vehicle cluster organised around Nissan.
So the automotive industry is still hugely important across the country as a whole when you add in not only the jobs in assembly but the supply chain but also related sectors and activities. It gets to about 850,000 jobs. So still a major player and still has a major benefit for the British economy.
David Bailey there and Dan Coffey on the history of car making in Britain. As we've just heard, the industry is really important for the UK economy, so it's no wonder Nissan's announcement has made such an impact. But what does the company's decision tell us about the challenges facing both it and the industry more broadly? I'm joined from Oxford by Matthias Holweg, professor at Oxford University's Said Business School, who's followed the car industry closely for 20 years. Matthias Holweg, what are the main factors that have put pressure on the car industry lately?
The mood in the car industry is not particularly buoyant for various reasons. For one, of course, there's the slowdown of car sales in China, the looming trade war with the US, and then the diesel emissions, of course, has also hit consumer confidence to replace their vehicles. So those factors, plus Brexit, of course, have really changed the mood in the car industry over the past months quite a bit.
We'll just explore some elements of that. If people are not buying diesels quite so much, why aren't they going out and buying a different kind of car?
Good question. So first of all, the motor vehicle is a durable good, which means you can extend its lifespan. There's generally no need to replace it. As you face uncertainty, you can actually just choose to run your car for a bit longer. Secondly, it really depends on your driving cycle. For inner city traffic, hybrids and petrol cars generally are better. You know, they don't face these restrictions. But for long distances, the diesel is still a very economical way of getting around. So it's just not clear what you need to buy.
So let's talk about the situation in Britain. How supportive has the UK government been of car makers during these difficulties?
Well, if you step back, for the past 10 years, the Automotive Council that we established in 2009 has been really helpful. And don't forget, the UK car industry has had a really good stretch of growing outputs. We've managed to increase local content. So it's just these last 2 years, of course, for the obvious uncertainty that this caused is the problem.
What about the long-term commitments by governments to get rid of diesel and petrol vehicles?
Well, I think these deadlines that have been set by, for example, the British and French governments are exactly the right thing to do because they create a certainty that is far enough in the future for the car industry to react and change. And don't forget, the current internal combustion engine needs to fund its replacement. So the vehicles we sell currently need to fund the R&D for future alternative powertrains to become viable.
Are you saying that if we stop buying as many diesel cars or petrol cars, then in effect we cut off the supply of money for research and development into the successor to the petrol and diesel cars?
In some ways, yes. Of course, you could argue that startup companies might fill in the gap. But there's a lot of knowledge that has been built up over the years how to make safe an economical motor car. So therefore, I think it's a much safer bet to entice current incumbents, if you wish, to develop new powertrains.
The reasons we're doing this programme, obviously, is because of the Nissan decision. How significant do you think this is for the wider UK car industry?
Essentially, the decision was made to build the X-Trail vehicle in Japan. The X-Trail is an SUV. It's heavy, so therefore, generally, it has a high proportion of diesel sales attached to it. So there are questions over how many would actually be sold. Then on the wider picture, there's the Japan-EU trade deal that is coming into force now, which will actually see the tariffs taper down. So therefore, it's quite a rational decision. And Brexit, of course, is one of those that comes again into the mix here.
Let's cut to the chase here. Do you think Nissan would have taken that decision whether or not there had been uncertainty over Brexit?
If you take the average car builds in the UK, let's say for £18,000, and then you look at the value of the components and you look at the value of components for those components that we bring into the country, then you apply the tariffs, say 4.5%, WTO rules, just a sort of a rough figure, you get to a few hundred pounds. If you look at the gross profit margin for that vehicle, it's between 10 and 15%. So that is a huge impact on vehicle profitability. So this concept of uncertainty translates directly into a significant reduction in profitability. And that is what car executives have been saying and saying on your programs over and over for the past 2 years.
So do you think we'll see more companies choosing to produce their models somewhere else?
My big worry is that during those times of uncertainty that the UK is placed in a particularly unfavorable position, because not just do we see, you know, the China issue and the diesel issue, but we also see this Brexit uncertainty. So therefore, at the moment, UK plants bidding for new models are in a worse position than they should be. And the worry that flows from that is we lose model after model, and eventually plants will become too small to be competitive, and then we'll close.
Mattias Holweg. Not an optimistic outlook, but could that change depending on the kind of Brexit we negotiate? And could there be opportunities ahead should alternative powered vehicles such as electric and driverless cars become mainstream? Joining me down the line from Manchester is Catherine Fiers, Operations Director at the consumer website Autotrader. And with me in the studio is Peter Campbell, Global Motor Industry Correspondent at the Financial Times, and Ian Henry, Managing Director of Auto Analysis and a specialist in the automotive sector. Peter Campbell, we heard earlier in the programme about some of the big challenge that the UK car industry is having to face up to. Would you say that over the years it's also made strategic mistakes which have put it in a particular position?
So Britain's car industry is undergoing something of an industrial renaissance following a large wave of international investment from many of the Japanese manufacturers. Now, in terms of future technologies, we're looking at electric cars and autonomous cars coming into the industry over the next few years and certainly a few decades. Those will fundamentally reshape what the car manufacturers have to do. And all car manufacturing, in a sense, comes down to scale. It's how many cars can you make? Can you make the largest number possible? And can you therefore spread those cars to get back the massive investments you have to make in developing those technologies? Now, Britain has always been an exporting nation for its cars, and so it has to be able to produce electric cars and to sell them widely internationally in order for that to work, compared to somewhere like mainland Europe, where they make 12, 13 million cars a year.
Do you think we bet the farm too much on diesel cars in the last few years?
Without a doubt, many of Britain's manufacturers are enormously exposed to diesel. Now, it's not exclusive to Britain. BMW in Germany and Mercedes and others also have very high diesel penetration. But Jaguar Land Rover, which is still Britain's largest car manufacturer, more than 90% of their sales in the UK and Europe are diesel. And to be fair to them, that is not entirely their fault. Governments across Europe and in the UK told all of us to buy diesel cars because they were more environmentally friendly. They produce less CO2 than petrol. And so JLR certainly bet the farm on diesel. And now, with diesel having fallen out of favour actually very rapidly in the space of 2.5 to 3 years, JLR is now facing a real crunch about this.
Ian Henry, do you think we've been slow here in the United Kingdom to move towards electric car manufacture?
I think everybody has been quite slow, to be honest with you. It took Tesla trying to disrupt the industry in North America.
Remind us who Tesla is.
Tesla, the new all-American company founded by Elon Musk, to begin the disruption process. But it's taken them a long time to even get to, what, 300,000, 400,000 cars a year. And they're a very small player. Now, following the diesel crisis as much as anything else, you've got Volkswagen in particular, but also the other premium German brands really accelerating and investing heavily in electric vehicles. And Volkswagen's got a new platform which will underpin upwards of 3 million or more electric vehicles by the middle of the next decade. And that will be transformative. And they will be doing that worldwide, at least 3 or 4 plants in Germany, a plant in Czech Republic, 2 in China, and 1 in North America.
But manufacturers in the UK, are they in the same game?
Well, we have Nissan, who makes, what, 50-odd thousand Leafs, but that's not anything on the same scale. And it's entirely dependent, one has to add, on Japanese technology.
And Jaguar, the Leaf is their electric brand.
Leaf is their electric car, yes. Yeah. Now, and the other point I'd make is that here in the UK, we talk about we as the country. There is very limited decision-making in this country for the future of the industry. Jaguar Land Rover, although it's Indian-owned, is fairly autonomous in decision-making, but all the other decisions about what takes place here, what models are allocated here, which markets we're given, whether they're electric or not, are made in Japan or Munich or elsewhere.
Catherine Fires, this is a very good point to ask you, whether you think consumers are close to embracing electric cars and that there's a significant near demand.
We believe they are, and we believe 2019 is going to be quite a pivotal year for electric vehicles in the UK. In our recent consumer research, 71% of consumers have said that they will consider buying an electric vehicle in their next purchase journey. And already on our platform today, we see 7% of consumer searches being for alternative fuel vehicles. And that's growing at a rate of about 40% each year at the moment.
So electric cars are the kind of veganism of the moment.
Yeah, there's certainly consumer awareness of them. Coupled with that, we've got the rollout of ULEZ in London in April.
The rollout of what?
The ultra-low emission zone in London, which is going to charge consumers £12.50 to enter what is the congestion charge zone today, but will become the north-south circular if they own a vehicle that doesn't meet certain emissions and engine standards. So consumer education and awareness through both manufacturer advertising and through the regulatory change that we're seeing in the industry is going to have a significant impact on the consumer, we believe, in the next 12 months.
What about the supply chain? Ian Henry, how ready are they for a switch towards electric car manufacture?
Well, in a word, they're not. Nissan assembled their battery packs from imported parts. I believe they import the motors and key components. Jaguar Land Rover has announced last year, earlier this year, a modest investment in a battery plant in the Midlands. I'm not quite clear yet whether that's going to be for hybrids or for full electric batteries, but that will again involve imported cells and other key components, and they're going to have to import the core bits of the electric motors they plan to make, because the UK doesn't have either the scale or capability to make enough steel of the right type for electric motors, nor stamp the steel.
Catherine Fires, given how expensive electric cars are at the moment, isn't it possible that just fewer of us will own them? We already tend to talk about how the next generation is now less ownership orientated and they're more likely to use public transport.
Well, the reality is the majority of consumers don't own their car today in the legal sense of the word. 92% of new cars are bought on finance. Over 30% of used cars are now bought on finance. So from an economic perspective, consumers don't own those cars. They are paying a monthly subscription, if you like, or in this case, a monthly finance sum, to pay to access that vehicle. That's a trend that has been growing in the industry over the last few years and has really driven affordability for consumers. Anything translated into a monthly cost feels more affordable. And so we think the combination of electric and finance is going to be quite interesting in the next few years. And with the emergence of subscription models from both the manufacturers and retailers in the industry that compress that finance life cycle to be even shorter, so you can sign up for a month or a few months to access a car. We think that's a great way for consumers to begin to test and trial electric vehicles.
So that begs the next question. Is the government here doing enough to support the industry make a transition towards electric cars?
We don't believe so. We think most of government intervention in electric is actually caused confusion and uncertainty for both manufacturers and consumers. Most of the legislation has been very much stick rather than carrot. It's been initiatives such as the Road to Zero or low emission zones that are penalising petrol and diesel engines rather than promoting the widespread adoption of electric vehicles. The infrastructure and charging network is probably the biggest case in point where we believe the government should have played a much bigger role in centralising both the underlying technology standards and also the density and rollout of those networks.
Peter Campbell, you were nodding along to that, but I want to take you on now to self-driving cars, because that's the other great futuristic picture that's been painted. The Department for Transport said, I think, that they expect driverless cars to be on the road by the end of the year. I think I read that somewhere. Is that your understanding?
So self-driving vehicles, by which we mean a car that can drive itself on the roads without a human behind the wheel to steer it back on the road if everything goes wrong, are incredibly good across the industry at generating an awful lot of hype. But there are enormous barriers to them being safe enough to use on the roads. And the main issue, of course, is safety. And so when politicians talk about these timelines, a lot of people in the industry whose job it is to solve these problems think, actually, that's quite ambitious.
Catherine Fires, how well equipped do you think UK cities and UK citizens are, actually, to cope with self-driving cars?
At the moment, most instances of where autonomous vehicles are being trialled or tested are in what we call islands of autonomy. So you are seeing pockets of private land like the Canary Wharf Estate and like Heathrow Airport, where you can create closed environments and you can control those environments quite carefully to enable first generation autonomous trials and tests. The technology is actually already safer than most humans are on the road. And so technology is definitely not going to be the barrier to adoption or change. It is going to be the regulatory and physical infrastructure environment that will need to evolve, even to create those closed loops environments. If you imagine somewhere like the City of London, with the winding streets, the multiple road users, buses, bikes, pedestrians that you would have to grapple with, and the actual lack of space in an area like that, it's incredibly challenging without central control and coordination of that infrastructure and estate to create an environment where autonomous vehicles could safely operate.
So you'd be better doing it in Los Angeles or somewhere like that. I want to move on now to the question that really gave rise to this discussion about the car industry, which was the Nissan decision and its Brexit context. Ian Henry, what do different forms of Brexit conceivably mean for the car industry?
Well, to some extent, it depends on the time scale that you're looking at. If we were to have a hard Brexit on March the 29th, there would undoubtedly be a significant disruption to the industry's modus operandi today. I would expect, at the minimum, a 10 to 12% fall in output this year alone, and that would probably continue going ahead. So in other words, last year we made a bit under 1.6 million. You'd lose at least 150,000 to 160,000 units a year this year going forward. We already know, irrespective of the kind of Brexit we're going to have, that BMW are closing the Mini plant for the month of April. Honda is cutting at least six production days. JLR is doubling its April shutdown maintenance period, all ahead of it.
That's Jaguar Land Rover.
Ahead of anticipated disruption. So we're going to see some loss of activity this year anyway. A hard Brexit would compound that. Going forward, if we got, say, either a single market or a customs union access or a combination of the two, then I would expect that existing UK production would be able to continue a little bit below current levels, but how much it would continue to get really new investment is open to debate. JLR, Jaguar Land Rover, has already opened a plant in Slovakia. So I think we will begin to see more of that.
Peter Campbell.
Anything that reduces the competitiveness of those UK plants, whether it's delays in importing their parts from Europe, whether it's tariffs they face when exporting those vehicles, anything puts them on a less strong footing where they're competing against those plants across Europe. And this is why the car industry has been almost unanimous in saying it doesn't matter what type of Brexit we have. If we have anything other than complete alignment with the customs union and the single market, it will really harm the industry and its ability to win new work.
Would that be so even if we got a lot better at selling into the domestic market what we produce?
So Britain right now buys around 2.5 million cars annually, the British public, and our factories make about 1.5 million cars. So if you look at that figure, there should be scope to produce in Britain the cars that you sell in Britain. But the problem is we produce a reasonably limited number of models here in the UK because car manufacturing is a scale game, and we have a huge consumer choice of the number of vehicles we can buy.
Ian Henry.
I think Peter's right. If you look at the top 10 best-selling cars in the UK, virtually all of them are made outside of the UK. The UK consumer is not very UK brand loyal. Another point which really does need to be made is the low level of UK originating content. And what I mean by that is that UK made vehicles have less than 50%, and in many cases less than 30% UK content in terms of the parts being made in the UK. When it comes to negotiating free trade deals, first of all, between the EU and the UK, free trade deals normally require, in any industry, the industry to achieve something like 55 to 60% originating content in order to be able to sell into the other market. without tariffs. Now, the UK will struggle. There's no doubt about that.
Peter?
This is actually incredibly significant for the long-term survival of the car industry post-Brexit, because it means Britain can go round and sign the best free trade deals with every country on earth. But if the cars that are made here don't cross the rules of origin threshold, they will still be subject to tariffs. And the motor industry in the UK has already warned that tariffs in the long term will lead to what they call death by a thousand cuts.
Peter Campbell there, and with him were Catherine Fires and Ian Henry. My thanks to them and to David Bailey, Dan Coffey and Matthias Holweg. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Helen Grady, Serena Tarling and Kirstine Knight. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We built up quite a library.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.